WGXC 90.7 FM, Acra, Hudson, Catskill. Hands-on and listener-supported radio.
The New York State Department of Environmental Conservation cautions New Yorkers to keep their distance and not to disturb newborn fawns or other young wildlife, as many animals are in the peak season for giving birth. Many people assume that young wildlife found alone are helpless and need assistance for their survival. However, in nearly all cases, this is a mistake, and typically human interaction does more damage than good. Should you find a fawn or other young wildlife, if you care, leave it there. Do not consider young wildlife as possible pets. For more information and answers to frequently asked questions about young wildlife, visit the DEC website at www.dec.ny.gov.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the Athens Cultural Center, bringing art, music, history, and dance to the community. The Athens Cultural Center is inviting artists to participate in an outdoor sculpture festival, imagining the effects of climate change on the Hudson Valley. The application deadline is June 30th. Information at athensculturalcenter.org under exhibits.
To let me know, should I stay or should I go? If you say that you are mine, I'll be here till the end of time. So you got to let me know, should I stay or should I go?
Hello, everyone.
Good morning.
This is Mitch Belgian.
And Shelley Menalasino with The Deciding Mind.
And we are here today. We have a great set of interviews. Our topic this morning is the narcissistic decision. So we were at the recent Association,
the American Psychiatric Association
meeting, and we had the great pleasure of interviewing two leading figures, both in psychiatry and in
the field of narcissism.
Well, I was going to say difficult patients, but our interest in this has to do with both patients and with how decisions are made in organizations.
Yes, and wow, what an opportunity to interview Otto Kernberg. He is a professor of psychiatry at the Weill Cornell Medical College, the Westchester Division of the New York Presbyterian Hospital. He's also a training analyst at the Columbia Psychoanalytic Institute. He's a brilliant writer, and we happened to follow Dr. Kernberg at the APA as he was actually autographing copies of his new book called Love and Aggression. What was shocking is in the midst of the autographing the books, he had to step away to take an emergency call. And I was just standing next to him, and I overheard him very calmly, and I realized it was a patient he was talking to. He was very calmly working around sort of the projections that were coming at him, and wow, to watch a master at work. So, Mitch, we're going to now go to the interview and let our audience listen to Dr. Kernberg, after which is about 20 minutes. We'll take a short break and then go. It'll be followed up with Frank Yeomans, a master clinician, and who's going to talk to us about different cases and a lovely interview, and that'll be the hour for today. All right, I think we're ready.
So without ado, here we go.
Narcissism, benign, and then malignant?
Narcissism means, in technical language, the quality of one's self appreciation, self-regards, self-esteem, the security one feels within oneself, the stability of one's concept of oneself. It's a normal function of pleasure with oneself, pleasure with one's experiences, with one's relations with other, with one's success, with one's gratification of one's own need. That's normal narcissism. Abnormal narcissism or pathological narcissism is characteristic of a certain personality disorder called narcissistic personality disorder that has been described for the last 30 years, and myself and my Institute for Personality Disorders have contributed to this study, and of course there is significant empirical research from many sources. It's characterized by an abnormal development of the feeling of self-regard, leading to a sense of grandiosity, importance, superiority, and maybe accompanied with a sense of omnipotence, a wish for dominance, and by the same token, a decrease of the capacity to invest in relations with significant others. Others tend to be depreciated, ignored, or envied because they have important qualities that we want to acquire. So we try to imitate them, suck them dry of whatever they have and we want to get, and then to drop them, like a dried out lemon. So one's relationship with others are impoverished. Narcissistic personalities have an exaggerated view of their importance, their grandiosity, no tolerance for any criticism. They have a sense of entitlement, greediness, then may become exploitive. And when their feelings of grandiosity are challenged because of criticism, they have difficulty of reacting normally, and they immediately, their self-esteem may collapse, so the grandiosity is like a bubble that explodes. And then they shift from grandiosity to feeling inferior, ashamed, humiliating, depressed, until their sense of grandiosity reconstitutes itself. In their relation with others, they have difficulty of establishing intimacy with others, difficulty in maintaining love relations over an extended period of time. They tend to devalue their sexual partners as part of the general tendency to devalue others. And very often you find them having sexual promiscuity. They fall in love, apparently get infatuated, lasts a few months, then they get disappointed, on to the next, and from one to the next. So they have a lack of capacity for maintained intimacy and a lack of capacity for empathy. Very great difficulty in really assessing others in depth. They can't assess themselves realistically because of that grandiosity that occasionally shifts into total inferiority, but usually is maintained. And others are for them, I would almost say, mysterious, except their external behavior, that they may attentively observe in order to get admiration that they do need from others, ongoing admiration to bolster their grandiose self. At the same time, they have a chronic feeling of emptiness because they lack the internalization of significant others, the internal world of friends, relatives, people whom you love and who love you. So there's a sense of emptiness. And in addition, the more severe cases have problems in their internal ethical system, their value system. They are honest not because they would feel guilty being dishonest, but because they feel ashamed if they are caught. So they are honest out of shame, not out of guilt. It's a shame culture, not a guilt culture. If they can't respond to criticism that's discreet, if it's extreme, they respond getting depressed. They have no.
They can't regulate.
That's right. Under more severe circumstances still, they may develop antisocial behavior. Exploitiveness, lying, stealing, conning, or if they are aggressively infiltrated, then attack, destruction of property, attack on people. And when aggression predominates, it infiltrates what we call their pathological grandiose self, and that becomes aggressive. And then you find people who are grandiose and very aggressive against others and also against themselves. And they become also very suspicious because they attribute their own aggression toward other people. So when we find a combination of patients with narcissistic personality and severe aggression with egosyntonic aggressive behavior against self and or others, and antisocial behavior, and paranoid, suspicious, distrustful tendencies, we talk about the syndrome of malignant narcissism, which is the worst-case scenario of the narcissistic personality. The next more extreme degree is no longer the narcissistic personality, but the antisocial personality in a strict sense, with total loss or absence of any moral conscience. Those patients no longer can be treated. That's the limit of what we can do to help.
So it's a spectrum from benign to malignant narcissism.
Right.
And it's a shame-based culture, you said?
The narcissistic personality, if they obey moral laws and legalities, is in order not to be caused and to be humiliated, not because they have an internal sense of moral justice.
And do people, you describe the spectrum, but people have qualities of all of these. Aren't they complicated? They have antisocial behaviors. They have malignant narcissistic behaviors.
There are, practically, we talk about the ordinary narcissistic personality disorder without antisocial features, who still maintain ordinary morality, still are able to, even if they have problems in intimacy, they are able to commit themselves to people, to relation, to work, although they are grandiose and omnipotent and have problems both in intimacy and at work. Then, more severe degree, they begin with antisocial behavior.
So they're often involved in organizations.
They involve the organization in several ways. An ordinary narcissistic personality may be dominant, pushy, inconsiderate of colleagues. Gradually, people dislike them. They don't know why, but they have really problem. They don't get promoted. They don't do well. Many, of course, are extremely ambitious and want to become CEOs immediately. So they, if they are talented and intelligent, they will work very hard and they get to the top. So there are organizations which have leaders with narcissistic personality. That's not good for the organization, because once they are in a position of leadership of an organization, then all the problems show. First, they can't receive real good feedback. They don't tolerate criticism. They only accept apple polishers around themselves. So they run the risk of getting isolated. They run the risk of antagonizing or pushing away honest critics and surrounding themselves by yes men and people who are opportunistic. And at the same time, demand to be loved and everybody should count out to them, which exhausts the organization. And because, although they may be very talented, because in the long run, they cannot consider the needs of the human needs of the organization, they create an enormous stress and they create the risk also of bad decisions because there is no feedback and nobody who is really helping them to have a viable source of corrective opinions.
And you speak specifically of them having trouble with decision-making in relevance to trouble with time. Is that right? That they can feel an urgency to make a decision?
No. Not an urgency, but they have to make it by themselves, tend to be absolutely secure in it, and sometimes that leads them to make wrong decisions. Now, when you get somebody with a syndrome of malignant narcissism direct an organization, that's a disaster, because then everybody not only has to love the leader, but obey the leader, and they attack viciously whoever seems to be on their way, so that the entire organization gets into a paranoid mood, and the organization divides into three levels. On the top, you have the sycophants, the yes men, usually with antisocial features, themselves opportunists and dishonest, a psychopathic layer. Underneath, the large majority becomes extremely paranoid. People are suspicious of everybody mutually. Who is going to betray me? The entire organization acquires a high level of paranoia genesis. And at the bottom are people with depressed features, usually the best people in the organization, who can't stand that and eventually leave. So this division into three levels is a consequence of a leadership by malignant narcissism.
As you're speaking, of course, I'm thinking of Hitler, Stalin, Mao.
Yes.
Are these models that drove you?
Mao, I haven't really studied. I can't say, but I have studied the life and biography of both Hitler and Stalin, and they are typical examples of malignant narcissism. In the case of Hitler, the grandiosity, not being able to listen to anybody. He was a disaster as a commander-in-chief of the German army, profoundly distrustful, hateful. Of course, his selected enemies were the Jews, almost delusional. There was an element of enormous personal aggression and sadism when there was the attempt at his life. He had all the leading conspirators hang by piano wires in a very slow death, had them filmed while they were agonizing for hours, and then for weeks saw these films again and again. So the grandiosity led him and the country to their ruin. And the same was true for Stalin. Grandiosity, distrust, manipulativeness, and sadism. People who were already had been condemned and were going to be picked up by the secret police, he invited them of his circle to have tea with him in the afternoon, and people who were invited for tea never knew whether it was as a reward system or because they had already been selected for elimination. And Stalin enjoyed greatly the terrible anxiety people. They were not psychopaths. Psychopaths, the antisocial personality, no longer has the capacity for any consistency. So these are already antisocial individuals who don't have a capacity for leadership. Both Hitler and Stalin had a tremendous organizational capacity. They knew how to get to the top.
So you would call them antisocial malignant narcissists?
These are malignant. I think that fits both Stalin and Hitler. Yes.
I think people would be very surprised to know that who we are discussing, malignant narcissists, would have a core of insecurity that's easily penetrated.
In the case of malignant narcissism, it's more difficult to penetrate it because their suspiciousness and their hostility tends to devalue whoever attacks or criticizes them. So they have, by their aggression against others, they are defended. The less severe narcissistic personalities are much more frail and suffer from feelings of inferiority than those patients with malignant narcissism. Although when patients with malignant narcissism feel kind of pushed into a corner, they may become suicidal. if they lose their omnipotence, preferable to get out of life.
Or exhibit bodily symptoms that are self-aggressive.
Well, there are patients, yes, whose chronic self-mutilating behavior has that basis of self-destructive impulses. It's not only borderline patients who are self-mutilating. Very severely narcissistic patients present that also.
If a person stands up to a narcissist that refuses to capitulate to a narcissist's demands, is that a methodology for people to resist narcissistic aggression? What personality structure would allow a malignant narcissist to back off?
Let's first of all talk about what would facilitate it. If they have a sexual partner who is severely masochistic, they are perfectly happy. But if a normal person stands up to them, of course the relationship would end. They would dismiss that relationship, end it. So normal person would only be able to free himself or herself from that relationship. In an organization, it is a major issue when you have narcissistic personality who fails in leadership position. That requires usually that those at the second level, immediately administratively below the leadership, get together and confront the leader or the board of the organization. That requires collective action. If anybody does it singly, he will simply be thrown out.
Yes.
So, organizationally, one has to confront them as a group situation, and that may become difficult in the case of malignant narcissism because the mutual paranoia is such that people can't get together. And once that three layering has taken place, and on the top you have all the antisocial personalities, they just intrigue against each other to keep themselves in power. That's what happened around Hitler. It's interesting that the most dishonest person of the entire bunch, Goebbels, was his closest friend. And his closest associates were narcissists who were only oriented to do whatever their Führer wanted. Goering, Bormann, Himmler.
But they knew they couldn't be Hitler.
No, they could not be. They did not have the kind of grandiosity and the demagogic talent, which was a real talent, Hitler had.
Are these qualities innate in people, or do they develop? Does someone go from being a benign narcissist to a malignant narcissist? Is it a process that happens in life, or are they born with tendencies?
No, it is development that takes place usually in childhood. One can make the diagnosis at ages 5 on. My first wife, Dr. Paulina Kernberg, who died in 2006, was the first one to describe narcissistic personalities in children.
Is intervention possible?
Yes. In fact, treating them, if you make the diagnosis in childhood, it's much better prognosis. Then it becomes, in adulthood, these are lengthy psychotherapeutic treatments. They are particularly difficult during adolescence. And in early adulthood, when everything goes, youth, health, growth, power, success feeds into the personality. Once youth and health and power fade, they get depressed in their 50s and 60s. They get depressed. And at that point, it's easier to start treating them and improve life later on.
It's not quite politically correct to start talking about five-year-olds as malignant narcissists and the need to intervene. There aren't many mothers who would say, yes, my child is a malignant.
Well,
not a malignant, but maybe has narcissistic traits.
There are parents who are afraid of their 10-year-old.
Right.
They know.
Right, right.
And do you think that's got a genetic?
The genetic disposition may be to the intensity of negative affect determining strong aggressive tendencies. But usually on top of this is an early childhood in which there was a significant lack of normal love relations, a tendency to use the child as a source of admiration for the parents, but not loved in itself. Or the child learns that it can be admired, but is not loved. So it may be a confluence of both these type of features.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Enjoyed your insights.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate your patience with me, waiting for me and the limitations.
Okay, well, that was our interview with Dr. Kernberg.
It was rather noisy. We were at the APA in their small media room.
And everybody was talking all around us. Okay, this is WGXC Radio, 90.7 FM.
Accra, New York.
We're broadcasting from Hudson and studios in Accra, Hudson, and Catskill, New York. Our second interview is coming right up. This is with Dr. Kernberg's colleague, Dr. Frank Yeoman. We asked him a similar set of questions, and he expounded more upon Dr. Kernberg. Dr. Kernberg had to leave early, and we were very glad to get Dr. Yeoman to speak with us. So here comes Dr. Yeoman.
It's a quieter interview in his office in Manhattan. He is the director of the Personality Disorders Clinic, and he actually goes on to give us some case examples. I hope you find them all interesting. We certainly did.
To start and ask Dr. Yeoman, how broadly would you sort of classify narcissism and problems with narcissism?
Well, this is a very good question. In a way, narcissism is a challenge for every living human because to a certain extent, you can conceptualize narcissism as one's relation to oneself. How do we think of ourselves? To what degree do we approve of ourselves, accept ourselves, and have a good relationship with ourselves? It's a little deviation from the myth of Narcissus, because that was clearly about a pathological narcissism, where Narcissus loved himself to the exclusion of the rest of the world. We'll get to that later. But in more modern psychoanalytic and psychological terms, narcissism is about one's investment in a healthy way in oneself, and the ability to sort of negotiate the tension between satisfying one's own desires and needs without getting into trouble in terms of the constraints of reality and what other people's points of views and positions are. So we want to not deprive ourselves so much that we're not satisfying our desires, but we don't want to express them, sort of give into them so much that we're a little out of control. So can we satisfy our human needs and feel good about ourselves? That's natural narcissism or healthy narcissism. But narcissism becomes a challenge when people aren't able to maintain that balance. And then we get into what we call pathological narcissism. And pathological narcissism is when there isn't a balance and the individual is invested in him or herself to the exclusion of satisfactory relations with other people. And this can take many different forms. The people who come into my office are usually what we call fragile or thin-skinned narcissists. These are people who develop a kind of exaggerated, grandiose sense of self, but it's paper thin. It's like a kind of a crystal sphere that they have created in their mind, but if you touch it, it's very prone to just shatter. So these fragile narcissists need to believe in that exaggerated, grandiose sense of self to feel good about themselves. Why? Because underneath, they experience themselves as lacking. And in fact, I would argue that's true of narcissists or pathological narcissists across the board. Even the more successful ones, we feel, have a core sense of inadequacy. So the grandiosity in the narcissism is a compensation for sense of inadequacy. But as I said, the ones who come into the office, they're thin-skinned, they're very subject to narcissistic injury, and they don't succeed so well in life, and they often get depressed.
What brings them in?
Well, the ones who come into the office very often have been misdiagnosed with depression for a long time. So they might come with depression. They might come because of unsatisfactory interpersonal relationships. They just can't get intimate with people, satisfactory relations on any level, because their sort of need to have their grandiosity validated by the world around them doesn't fly with most people. Most people aren't willing to go. So depression, poor interpersonal relationships. And I would also say, I think there's probably a whole world of hidden narcissists out there in our society. Why do I say hidden? Some of my patients who are dealing with their own problems, but at least facing them and having some success in dealing with them, talk about the brother, the sister at home, who never gets out of the house, who graduated from college or from law school, and just when it looked like they were going to start a life, they get paralyzed. And there are a lot of hermits in these sort of situations, and you hear about them through your patients who are at least in touch enough to know they need help.
That's so they're staying at home avoiding narcissistic injury?
Reality is something they can't contend with. Usually it's because of a projection onto the world around them. Narcissists, especially the fragile type, the thin-skinned type, have extremely demanding standards. You're either perfect or you're nothing. And they don't often realize that that's their stuff. The world is a little bit more forgiving. The world gives you a little leeway. So if you're thinking, every time I make a move, if it's not perfect, I'm going to get slammed, you retire, you isolate, you retreat. So I think there are a lot of people in these sort of protective cocoons
who have trouble with failure or with potential failure.
Yeah. They have trouble with self-assessment. They can't assess themselves accurately. They don't have a measuring stick that has any flexibility. So they just sort of retire into a kind of almost a non-existence.
That would almost be thought of as an inferiority complex.
Well, it's two sides of the coin. You do have a whole category of narcissists who are quite fascinating. They come into the office looking like the most downtrodden people in the world. They look depressed. They've achieved nothing in life. And you start treating them as depressive. The more you get to know them, again, I'm talking about this particular group, you find out that underneath what looks like an inferiority complex are the most demanding and rigid standards. Why haven't they succeeded? They don't make compromises. All these people you see around you in Manhattan, why have they succeeded? They've been willing to compromise. I don't compromise. And I am a pure person because I don't compromise. So you see, underneath the inferiority is a moral superiority.
So have many of your patients been treated by clinicians elsewhere and typical treatment didn't work, say, regular antidepressants, regular kinds of therapy?
Absolutely. It's very frustrating. I don't want to sound too critical of psychiatry, but it is a field where often...
You are a psychiatrist,
I am a psychiatrist.
Okay.
And actually, I should add that when we talk about therapy, therapy is obviously not the exclusive domain of psychiatry. So we're talking about psychologists and psychiatric social workers and even some other types of therapists. So I don't want to just pin the blame on psychiatry. Let's just say that therapists in general, from my point of view, often don't take enough time doing a careful diagnostic assessment, and they just treat what's on the surface. If you're a narcissistic patient whose life is miserable because you've never been able to live up to your impossibly demanding standards, you come in and say, I'm depressed. That's not the same as a biological depression. And it's very disconcerting. I've treated many people in this office who for 10 years were treated as though they had a biological depression. They were on every antidepressant medication under the sun. And within an hour of talking with them, you realize it's something else. It's not their neurons. It's not their neurotransmitters. It's an attitude within their mind. It's the frame of mind that whatever I do isn't good enough. And then before you know it, you're hearing that nobody else is good enough either. Because what comes around goes around, and the same impossibly demanding standards they impose on themselves, they lay on others too.
So that would be called more of a characterological disorder?
Exactly. That's a characterological depression based on the narcissistic dynamic, the dynamic being that one can never attain the perfectly demanding standard that one has to live up to, and if one doesn't achieve that, one is nothing. There's a kind of sense of emptiness underneath this demandingness.
I asked Dr. Kernberg this question, but I think perhaps it warrants going into a little more. Are people born this way? Do they develop this way? I mean, the gradations of narcissism, are they a tendency that one is born with and is amplified through upbringing? Is it environment? Does it get worse?
Well, that's a great question, and if we can take a little detour and then get back to it, I think we'd have to look at the levels again, because I talked some about healthy narcissism, I talked about pathological narcissism, but without going into the different subdivisions of that. And what I've talked about mostly, the depressive presentation, is what we consider sort of more normal narcissistic personality disorder. But as Dr. Kernberg described, there's a more serious level called malignant narcissism, where there's a lot of aggression intertwined with it. And with the malignant narcissist, they not only have envy, because underneath their grandiosity, they feel that others have a certain kind of inherent quality they don't have. But the malignant narcissist gets a pleasure out of destroying. If I can't have it, I'll destroy it. Very pernicious trait. But it is a complex phenomenon. People who only care about themselves usually only care about themselves because they feel they're not all there. And instead of doing what it would take, which is what we try to do in therapy, which is create a human connectedness and look at the blockages to being connected, the narcissist feels they have to blow themselves up because they're just not, this sort of not the core stuff of the human being. So at once they're blowing themselves up in a grandiose way and envying others, and thus these more ill ones have to attack and triumph over others to feel good about themselves. In the most serious cases, well, of this nature, somebody will seem to be doing well in therapy for a while, and then they'll kind of catch themselves because they experience their progress as the therapist's victory. It shows the therapist has something to offer, and has some goodness and some qualities. And then when they feel that their progress is the feather in the therapist's cap, they'll feel it's a humiliation because it's the therapist's kind of demonstrating their superiority. And in the worst cases, they'll kill themselves to triumph over the therapist. There are cases of that. But just to finish off, at the lowest rung of the ladder in the narcissism.
Meaning the most severe?
The most severe type of narcissistic disorder overlaps with antisocial personality, where not only does the person care only about itself, the antisocial is defined as only caring about themselves, and the only interest they have in any other person is the degree to which they can use and exploit that other. These are cases that often are called psychopathic. So to get back to Mitchell's question about etiology, our colleague Michael Stone, who talks a lot about the antisocial personality and who's even now begun to talk about evil in his latest writings and his appearances on television, we can't figure out what developmentally leads to this total lack of conscience of the antisocial, and there does seem to be something in the brain organically there. But as to the less hopeless forms of narcissism, the ones we feel we can treat in therapy, it does seem that there are developmental issues mixed in there. And Dr. Kernberg mentioned some. Say the child is seen as a narcissistic extension of the parent and not given a sense of being loved and cherished for who he or she is, but being admired for what they can produce or what they can do in terms of activity or performance. So if you grow up and you're not sure you're loved for your inherent self, but you're loved more for what you do and what you produce, then there's this doubt. And it's this core doubt about self-worth that we think is beneath a lot of the narcissistic grandiosity.
I'm curious about the aggression.
Yeah.
And I wonder if the aggression is some form of revenge.
Well, yes, but it's more than that, I would say. First of all, I want to pick up on aggression just as a psychological phenomenon, and I want to make an editorial comment. Because we live in an age where a lot of my colleagues, I learned from being on panels at conferences, don't think there's an inherent aggression in the human being. They see that anger and aggression are reactions to trauma or mistreatment, but they don't see a core aggressive drive, which I find very naive. It seems to me that just in terms of human evolution, we wouldn't have survived as a species if we didn't have our aggressive drives. And that aggression is not just pure and simple a bad thing. It's a sort of an energy that can be channeled into all sorts of productive things like creativity and competition. So when you talk about aggression as revenge, I'd say, yeah, it can be channeled that way, but it's not only that. So aggression fits into the narcissistic dynamic because going back to the basic problem we all face of how to feel good about ourselves by both satisfying our desires but fitting into a civilized world, we all have to figure out what do we do with our aggressive drives? How do we channel them? And our self-esteem is partly based on how successful or unsuccessful we manage that. So when we talk about narcissists, and as we go from the less to the more severe, as you get to the more severe, they have mastered less well their aggression, and they probably have a more intense aggressive temperament, that is in their brain. In their brainstem, in their limbic system, the parts of that that have to do with aggressive affect are just probably more present or more intense than in your average. So the revenge element would indeed have to do with people whose inferiority and sense of self-worth is always measured by comparisons with others who they see as superior and who they have to knock off their pedestal and defeat. The irony is that some narcissistic people are extreme achievers, but they feel that they fall short because no matter how much they achieve, it's not that ideal. We all live, I would hope, with an ideal of image of who we should be, but most of us, I hope, can give ourselves a little slack and say, well, you know, if I get close to that, I'm fine. For the narcissist, you either are the ideal or you're a failure.
But they often have a lot of trouble with relationships, right?
Yeah.
And so I wonder, what's it like in the office trying to engage them in a relationship?
Well, I think I can speak for many therapists. I think it's the biggest therapeutic challenge. The group that I work with started out specializing in borderline personality disorder, which is a very interesting and complex condition, which used to be quite a treatment challenge, but different models of treatment have developed. And we've had a feel we know in most cases how to deal with that. There are still some cases that escape us. But in our group, we noticed, as we discuss our cases with each other, we were having more trouble with the narcissistic patients. It's really a challenge because they come in. Take this lady I had in mind, treated for 10 years for depressive disorder. And why did I know in the first meeting that she wasn't depressed? First of all, she was dressed to the nines. That doesn't look like a depressed person. And she was depressed because she couldn't achieve a certain professional status. I won't go into details, but in her mind, either she succeeded in this particular career or she was going to kill herself. No question in her mind. And I could see the dynamic of the person who is judging themselves too harshly and too severely. And underneath that, she had a sense of not being worth anything. But you couldn't say that right away because it's too hidden, it's too painful to have direct contact with. So when you have somebody in the office like this, the challenge is to understand them, but to lead them to the understanding very gradually, because any challenge to their grandiosity could cause the crystal globe to shatter. And then it's a horrible feeling of annihilation and emptiness. And either they get depressed or they flee treatment. You can't challenge these people too quickly. So the question is, what these people like is to have people sort of validate their grandiosity, which leads you into a position where you're really not being honest because you don't see the grandiosity as reality-based. So you neither validate the grandiosity, but you don't challenge it right away. You kind of let it open up in the sessions. And then you see what happens with you. As you predicted, Shelley, usually they start, sooner or later, finding fault with you. Because what do they want? They want the ideal therapist. They want somebody who knows everything, can fix everything. So we just wait for the stage of devaluing us. It doesn't usually take long because we're not the perfect provider. You know, 3 weeks into treatment, I don't know what's different from all the other therapists. I was referred to you because you're supposed to be a specialist. This is no different. You don't know what you're talking about. So instead of getting defensive, you say, it must be really hard to come to somebody expecting that they're really going to do just the perfect job, and that's not what you find. So what you're doing here is modeling that you can be imperfect without being destroyed by that. You can have an honest talk about the fact, okay, I'm not the guy you hoped for, I'm not ideal, but we can talk about that without my either becoming defensive or just sort of, you know, being demolished by the discussion. And in that relationship that develops, the person begins to realize, if all goes well, that perhaps underneath their grandiose shell, there might be a wish to connect. And maybe you can connect to somebody without it being a sort of who's on top game. Because in their mind, relationships are just who's in the superior position and who's in the inferior position. It's just innate. It's somehow embedded, imprinted. That's what relationships are, the superior one and the humiliated one. And if you manage to sort of establish a relationship, the person might begin to question their assumptions. That's why we work in the here and now, what's happening in the session. When we find what we call a relationship dyad, a particular pattern of self in relation to other, we always find it both within the mind of the patient and then as it unfolds in other relations, including the one with us. So the lady I was talking about, here she is going through life tortured by this idea, you're never good enough, you didn't do that well enough, you're stupid, you're worthless. So before you know it, that same thing is being experienced between the patient and me. And of course, those things flip. And she's assuming that I'm thinking that of her. I haven't said that and I'm not thinking that, but it's a projection. It's an assumption that minds all work in a similar way and we have to help people realize they don't. So the extreme demandingness can be an attack that destroys what would be a realistic but imperfect other or self.
So one of your approaches is transference-focused psychotherapy. I think most people get mixed up with transference versus projection.
Yeah, but transference and projection, no wonder it's confusing because they're hand in hand. Transference in the Freudian sense, which we don't use exactly now, was transferring what was in the past onto the present. I don't disagree with that. But what we focus on now is that a patient's mind is made up of images from the past that have been processed and kind of reorganized. So it's not a photographic replication of the past. It's we call it their internal world. Each individual's internal world, including ours here in this room, is made up of certain personae that correspond more or less accurately to the world around us. So transference is a universal phenomenon. When you met me, you said I reminded you of somebody you knew.
Exactly.
So you're transferring images of that guy onto me. And as you get to know me, you'll see what fits and what doesn't. You'll adjust to the reality. If you had a personality disorder, the reality wouldn't have so much of an impact. Your internal image would be what determines your perception, and reality wouldn't make much of a dent on
that. I can't believe what you did to me, Rodney, last week.
But then
I'm the victim of your projection. Now we can relate it to projection, you see. But the difference with projection is that projection is specifically the seeing in the other the unwanted parts of the self. And with patients, it usually does have to do with the aggressive stuff.
I wanted to ask about empathy, because in this train of
simple, more serious types of narcissism, yeah. and including sort of the more antisocial type.
Yeah.
Where does empathy fall in? So since they have trouble with relationships, yeah. they have trouble thinking about the other person, considering the other person.
Yeah. Well, let's start with the more simple narcissist. The more simple narcissist, or straightforward, is so preoccupied with themselves, they're kind of oblivious to others. So there's a lack of empathy there. I don't know if you ever saw the Carol Burnett skit where she does a parody of Gone with the Wind, but she presents Scarlett as like such a total narcissist that she's going into this histrionic fit when Red is leaving, and he comes back, whoever played, you know, her sidekick there, and he's about to say, "Frankly, dear," and she just slams the door in his face because he doesn't even get to say his famous line because she's so wrapped up in her own stuff, it's like he's peripheral. So in simple narcissism, the preoccupation with the self doesn't leave room or emotional space for wondering about others. So it's kind of sad. But as you go down to the more antisocial parts, we find an interesting phenomenon. We used to think that antisocial people, in their preoccupation with self and their concern only about self, were lacking in empathy. They didn't think about others. They didn't think about what others were thinking or feeling. And then I read this in an article by Glenn Gabbert. I don't know if it originated with him, but it might have. He said, you know what? A lot of people with antisocial personality have a very keen understanding of how the other person's mind works. They get it. The usual person, like the three of us in this room, I hope.
And our audience.
We assume empathy goes hand in hand with sympathy. If you understand what's going on in a person's mind, you sympathize with it. What the antisocial people do, the extreme form of narcissism, is they use that understanding to exploit. Think about a con man. They get the other person, and then they use that understanding to make use of them in a ruthless way. So empathy is tricky. You have to decide if it's going with sympathy or being used for other purposes.
So you try to not have the rules change when you're working with...
Essential. But since you bring up rules changing, that's another aspect of narcissism. People with narcissism don't think the rules apply to themselves. Going back to the developmental picture, what is a sense of self, an adequate sense of self? It's an internalization of multiple relationship experiences that coalesce into a harmony. And along with that, there's a sense of moral value. I'm not saying which moral values you should have, but if you're going to be a person who can live in harmony with yourself, you have some sense of what's right and wrong with some coherence and harmony. Narcissists don't have that integration. And in a way, this very kind of disconcerting, they just feel the rules don't apply to them. And sometimes they get away with it. And sometimes they get away with it for long periods. And sometimes it almost becomes a game of dare. They think that their ability to not respect the rules and get away with it is proof of their superiority. So bending and making exceptions is very often the case. It's a recipe for future problems. We get a lot of young people in our offices, college age. They sometimes write bad checks. They misuse credit cards. Sometimes they gamble. Often there's substance abuse, traffic violations, and they've always been bailed out by the well-intentioned parents. The first rule is you have to have a coherent system that they have to live by. They have to realize there are consequences. And in most cases, it's a disaster for the individual because they can't do that indefinitely. And sometimes it's a disaster for the world around them because they can become tyrants later on.
And then they have very little experience with failure.
Yeah, or if they fail, they deny and sort of externalize blame.
That is actually one of the hallmarks of failure in organizations is that blame is externalized. We give ourselves credit for all of our successes and we blame failure on others.
Yeah. What's fascinating to me is how the human mind can be so kind of encapsulated for some people from the rest of the world, how just in the way you described, and this is the hallmark of narcissism, anything bad, anything imperfect is out there. What's in me is perfect. And it leads to some very scary things.
But I would assume if you have a narcissist in a decision-making position who chooses between the welfare of a large group and of themselves, that this is a done deal. If the system sets up such a situation that they are condoned for choosing themselves over the welfare of others, it can create a problem for society.
Yeah. Well, here I will allow myself sort of a, I don't know if polemical is the right word, but since I'm not either a philosopher or a political scientist, I can say what we in psychoanalysis would call wild analysis. It seems to me that if you look at the history of the 20th century, it seems that Marx, who may have been an idealist, I don't know his works well, didn't get narcissism. He didn't get the fact that for some people, they don't give a damn about the collectivity. You know, he just thought we're all part of this group and we're all thinking about the group. And, you know, within a generation, you get Stalin, who was one of the worst narcissists in history, who totally turned that system on its head, where it was a, you know, extremely tyrannical system where people suffered endlessly and unimaginably. But you wonder about capitalism, too, because the people I know who tend to be the strongest defenders of capitalism and, you know, just let businesses do everything, you know, the best will rise to the top. I don't think they get narcissism either. Because if capitalism is going to work, it has to have the future in mind. And capitalism, if it's going to work, would assume that the people who are rising to the top are not thinking about just how many billions am I going to have by the time I die. They're going to be thinking about, you know, what is the future of our society? What is the future of my business that I've spent so much building up? What's the future of my grandchildren?
You know, Adam Smith actually had in mind a moral basis of society that capitalism operated in. It wasn't just this blatant sort of capitalism that we now see with libertarians. Well, it assumed a moral society and that there would be constrictions to behavior.
Yeah. And I think the people I know who are the biggest defenders of just total free market capitalism don't understand the narcissistic and the psychopathic antisocial mind. People who will abuse the system to their own end and the hell with the rest.
Mm-hmm. So they assume people will follow rules.
Exactly. And it's sad because some of the strongest proponents of certain political positions are totally naive because they just make these assumptions that show an ignorance about certain character types. And they're exactly the character types that are likely to rise to the top if sufficient rules aren't in effect.
I have a closing question I think would be interesting, which is, as a therapist, it is assumed or thought that you have to have empathy for your patients. When you have someone come in who is a narcissistic personality type, it must be a struggle to empathize with them, to have sympathy for them, or...
So you're talking about, like, more robust?
Well, more, I would say the more malignant. I was going to say the same thing. I have no problem empathizing with a standard, sort of straightforward narcissist. They are struggling as best they can to defend against a feeling of inadequacy. And they're not hurting most of the world around them. You know, they might make life difficult for people, but mostly they're suffering. And again, as you said, those would be the more thin-skinned or fragile ones. It's easy to empathize with them. They have a hard time empathizing with themselves. If you go down to the most severe category, then I would say, yes, I have a difficulty empathizing with them, but I would also argue that my job is not to empathize with them, because on the rare occasions where we get somebody who is a true antisocial in our offices, once we've made that diagnosis and that assessment, our job is to protect those around them. So if we get a young adult, say, who is truly antisocial, then we engage the family to create a system. It's sort of like damage control. And only then is there hope that the person might change some, and even then, it's not a great prognosis.
That would be a similar prescription for an organization, I would believe.
Yeah. The problem with the organization, and I'm not an organizational consultant, but if the problem is at the top, then you don't have the parents sending the problem in for therapy. You've got somebody running the organization who doesn't want to acknowledge there's a problem.
But you might have the board of directors.
If the president or CEO didn't hand